Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everyone, welcome back to part two of the Stompcast. We're just chuckling away really because we're stood under this pagoda. It's just like belting it down with rain. Now it seems to have stopped. If it does completely stop, we'll get out. But otherwise, what we're thinking we'll do is just walk on the spot. So we're still stomping away, aren't we, Josh, really?
Yeah. Oh,
keep
yeah.
it moving. Yeah. Keep the health going. We need to... Charlie's doing a great impression of stomping away. It's brilliant. Hello, everyone. I hope you're well. Thank you for joining us. And I'm sure you've enjoyed part one. In part two, I'm really looking forward to talking about this because anxiety is something that is talked about quite a bit as a phrase, a term. You see it everywhere. But perhaps we don't think about what it actually is that much. If you're listening now and I said to you, pick up a pen and paper and write down in, say, three sentences, what is anxiety? Do you feel confident you could really encapsulate it? I think it's quite a hard thing to define. So, no pressure. Are called anxiety, Josh.
Yeah, yeah. It's fine.
What is anxiety? What is it?
Anxiety, I like to split kind of into two. You've got your conventional anxiety and your kind of inwards, kind of disordered anxiety. Now, we all get conventional anxiety, which is a mixture of doubt and fear. That's the cocktail. Mostly doubt. Then fear kind of exacerbates that doubt. You know it's anxiety because it always begins with what if. So if your thought is what if, then you're anxious. Mm. Yeah, that's it. What if that happens? Mm. No. Then you're anxious. It comes with an array of feelings. So it could be nervousness, trepidation, or utter terror and panic. And it could be a sense of doom, a sense of foreboding, as Brené Brown says. It varies along the kind of intensity spectrum. And then it's physical as well. So you could have tight chest, heart palpitations. We spoke about dissociation before, derealization, not feeling like you're here. You could have tense jaw. For me and a lot of people, like my stomach goes, my digestion's completely finished. It takes a while for that to come back. You perspiring, things like that. Basically, you remember Woolworths. It's like a Woolworths pick and mix. First aisle, you've got thoughts that begin with what if. The second aisle is the kind of feelings along the intensity spectrum. And on the third one, you've got an array of physical symptoms. And they can present differently as well. I said before about kind of how you've got conventional anxiety. This is anxiety that we all relate to. You know, what if my job interview doesn't go well? What if I fail my driving test? What if the boss isn't happy with me? I don't know, what if I forgot to put the bins out? We can all relate to that, you know? What if my first date doesn't go very well? And you can bring that up in conversation. It's societally acceptable to say that. The other side of anxiety, the other type of anxiety, where that doubt and that fear focuses, is the inwards disordered stuff. So this is when you fear, and then you wonder why you feel so scared. Have you ever just been anxious for no reason?
Definitely.
And then it makes you feel scared about why you're anxious for no reason.
Like a deep sense of unease almost.
Yes. The deep sense of unease, and then you're questioning why. And then we try to cognitively work out why we feel that way. And we end up doing things like ruminating or overthinking, as it's distastefully called. We play out scenarios and catastrophes in our brains because we do that to try and desensitize ourselves in case that catastrophe happens. We have intrusive thoughts that I mentioned before. And we can just panic and worry about the next time we panic. And that's the other side of anxiety, with the inwards disordered stuff. And one in five people experience that, so it's incredibly common. But we all experience anxiety, even the conventionally toughest people you know. We'll all have anxiety, and it's just sometimes it's how it presents. It's there as a doubt mechanism, because when we doubt something, we keep an eye on it. Now, for our ancestors, fantastic. You know, I'm doubting my safety. I'll look for lions, tigers, bears, whatever. Brilliant. That means my great, 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 great Auntie Jane is safe now because she anticipated a bear attacking her. When you're stood in the office walking around London or on holiday on the beach and that doubt response is kicking off, that's when it gets a bit sticky and annoying.
And it feels a bit pointless of that thing, not just pointless, but it ruins that when those things happen, it actually destroys moments that you're not in any danger, or that you're not even facing that stuff. And that's what's frustrating with anxiety a lot of the time. It's, you know, if you're nervous right before an exam, that's like somewhat appropriate. Obviously, we can talk about when it's too much, if it's stopping you engaging the exam or it's causing you a lot of distress. But you feel nervous before an exam is part of it, right? Or if you're doing a speech. But it's when you're like on holiday, like you said, and you just sat with that unease, and it might be about something that's in 3 weeks' time. You're such in a state of unease, you can't actually be present and enjoy that moment. And I guess my question was going to be like, when does it become a problem? And I guess, is that part of it? It's like, it's when it's not appropriate. It's happening when it shouldn't be, almost.
Yeah, when it's chronic and excessive. When it's because sometimes when we're stressed, that can turn into anxiety quite easily, that threat response, that doubt response. And sometimes that can come with you. So if you've been working hard and then day one of your holiday, you're feeling anxious, that's to be expected. Your body's trying to calm down. It's trying to get to a place of homeostasis. It becomes a problem when it's most days. So some people every day, some people all day. For me, it was all day, every day for about a year, which I thought I was going crazy or I was broken or something.
It must have been awful just to have that every day, like just to be in a constant state of anxiety. Like, you know, I've struggled a lot more. I have struggled with anxiety, but a mixture of anxiety and depressive episodes of real low mood. But like when you're in states of anxiety, like to do that continuously for a year is just... That's rough, isn't it? Let's be honest, that's rough.
It's really rough.
It's rough. Yeah.
Do you know what? I look back, Alex, and I'm like, wow, that's like a different world.
Do you think, like, how did I do it? Sometimes I look at certain times where I've been through difficult times, and like I know that you've been through some difficult things in your life, and when you look back and think, how did I bloody do it? How did I get through that?
You know, I know how I did it, and it takes a lot of courage that I didn't think I had, you know. I was too scared to leave the house or even go to, at one point, my lowest, even go to the bathroom, because I thought that this one place was my safe space, and if I moved anywhere, I would freak out, and the anxiety was that bad. Mm. Now I'm swimming in Regent's Park with you. And
you are basically one of the ducks right now. Start quacking and you are one.
Exactly, I will. That's for afterwards. That's what I do in one of my hobbies. It took a lot of, again, psychoeducation, learning out why my brain was doing what it was doing. For people with like GAD, generalized anxiety disorders, the most common diagnosed things in the country, this is a very simplified kind of explanation, but this is when worry, the brain thinks that worry is helpful for things not going wrong. So for example, let's say I'm worrying that I forgot I locked the door, and I'll walk around all day worrying that I forgot to lock the door. Then let's say I get home and lo and behold, the door was locked. The brain remembers then that, the bad thing didn't happen, but the brain also remembers that you worried all day. So it attributes some of the credit to that worry, even though it was nonsense, you know. But it's really convincing.
That's a really powerful example, isn't it? Like to think of it, I hadn't quite thought of it that way, where it's like, It's not just a perpetual cycle. We're actually, we're feeding that cycle almost like a positive reinforcement by saying, oh yeah, you're really very anxious and worried, and then that bad thing didn't happen. Therefore, you being this hypervigilant state, is your brain thinks that's preventing the outcome, but it isn't. It was detached from your reality. Right?
Absolutely, I call it meerkat mode, and I use this with when I'm teaching the kids. It's like we have a meerkat mode and a sloth mode. I love sloth mode, it's the best one. Rest and digest mode. But meerkat mode is when we're constantly hypervigilant. Picture a meerkat on the edge of the burrow, looking for threats. And that's great. Humans copied the meerkat, and it was fantastic. But the meerkat has to have that because they're surrounded by predators all the time. You know, when I'm walking through Asda trying to buy them a tub of ice cream, I don't need to have this meerkat mode on, but I need to look at what I'm doing that's keeping it on. So part of what I got better was realizing okay, what am I doing that's keeping the worry here? I need to be very compassionate to myself. I don't need to keep slipping into do's this, I need to do that. But really looking at what I'm doing, and actually for me it was avoiding. I would avoid the scary thing because I didn't think I'd be able to cope with the threat response, with being in meerkat mode too intensely. And when I realized I could handle it, and everyone can, to the limit that they're comfortable with, I started to open up my life a bit more and started to get confident. Call it the willful tolerance of discomfort. You know, it's not the biohack that you see on social media, but it's the one that's kind of grounded in science and psychology, in psychological research. And I'm trying to make it accessible and fun for people, as opposed to, you know, do this now and your panic disappears. It's like, no, I tried doing all that. I need to look at what I'm doing here and to get the credit for being brave and tolerating those horrible feelings.
Well, we're going to come on to in part three some of the things that you can do to help with anxiety. Let's sit with a little bit further with the kind of what is it type thing. What do you think predisposes people to anxiety? Some of it I understand is going to be related to things like genetics, what your upbringing might be, the kind of thoughts and the environment that you kind of had, whether you've had traumas or not. But it does seem when you look around as you grow up, there's certain people that seem to have a more anxious predisposition, whereas other people have a more kind of, sloth one, maybe, as an example. So what plays into that? Because sometimes, I think people end up kind of beating themselves up quite a bit. Think, what did I do wrong? You know, why have I ended up like this? I'm like this. And obviously that's not helpful. But what kind of contributes to anxiety as a predisposition sense, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, so we have the nervous systems inherited from our parents. You know, my mum and dad, quite anxious people. And so therefore, thanks mum and dad, I've got that nervous system. Does it mean I'm going to, you know, I'm doomed and that anxiety is going to overcome me for the rest of my life? No, but I am more susceptible. My sensitivity to anxiety and my sensitization is going to be higher than, say, your mate who can sleep through Armageddon, the really frustrating mate that can just be chill with everything. That's part of it. A lot of it's to do with going through stuff, trauma, grief, stress. For me, it was all three at once, and that kick-started this excessive anxiety that I had for many years. A lot of it's to do with understanding how your brain works, particularly with neurodivergence. More and more people talking about ADHD. I have autism. So for me, sensory input is just, I got to be, just accept that actually when I go to a gig, which I love, but it's going to exhaust me more than the guy who's been there since 10 a.m. and won't go home till 3 a.m. You know, I've got to be like, right, I've got to realize that the sound and lights, my brain's going to be working a bit harder than those guys. And that creates anxiety too. Things around us, just things going on, like, you know, climate, things going on in the news, stuff like that, that contributes to it. I always use the stress jug. It's like when your stress jug overflows, you get that threat response, you get that dump of adrenaline, and you feel that intense anxiety. You got to look at what's in your stress jug. Sometimes we'll have shared stresses. Sometimes you have your own personal stuff in there as well. And it's about work. I, as a therapist, kind of work with what's in the stress jug. Let's have a look what's in there today.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's almost like you've got like a capacity almost, and if you build that jug up to the limit, it's going to pour over the top. So you need to deal with what's in there and try and like kind of scoop some of that out to kind of build your capacity again. Because like life is what it is. There's always going to be stuff that's stressful, that is potentially anxiety inducing. That's just life, isn't it? But it's, if we're just carrying around this like heavy, the other one I like is the suitcase analogy. You know, you're carrying the suitcase full of, if it's full of all these difficult things you're hanging on to that are dragging you down, then your capacity to put more clothes in and, or drag a bit more is going to be reduced, isn't it? Versus if you kind of, you're dealing with things, you're unpacking, you're decompressing from that suitcase. So it's light and it's, you're nimble, you're not being weighed down heavily, right?
Yeah, and you can fit more pies in it then as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't know why I was thinking about that.
You really want to have a pie tonight, don't you? Yeah, is that the plan?
That was my intrusive thought as you were talking. Then.
Is that your
plan? This really powerful point, and I'm just like, I wonder how many pies you could put in there.
Put in there, yeah. No,
you're truly, it's about that. And I think when you ask about the disposition, I think some people, I call it, whether using a jug or using the suitcases, that some people just have bigger suitcases, and you've got to accept that. Like, it's, some people are lucky. For me, you know, someone with, you know, a neurodivergent guy who's gone through grief, trauma, anxiety disorders, various things all at once, and the jug overflowed. Yeah, I mean, that's going to overflow. It's going to cause my nervous system to go into overdrive. I'm going to feel like I'm dying, having a heart attack, going crazy. Mm. When some other people just have it, just have the luck, really, and the circumstances to be able to do that. Or what isn't nice when people compare, they're like, why am I anxious and this person isn't? And we have this emotionally conservative thing where we revere our ability to tolerate stress and horrible things. I'm like, I never got that. If anything, the people with the smaller suitcases dealing with that overflow, dealing with that anxiety, go into work every day and despite feeling anxious. Isn't that like, that's more courageous than your luck?
Also, I think there's the biggest, one thing I've learned a lot, I think, in my life about this is that, you know, probably from A&E, partly from just life in general, is that you have no idea, not just what people are going through, but what they're going to go through. And you sometimes you look at somebody, you go, that person you know, and you always wish well of everyone around. You think, God, they've had it easy in life and I've had it so tough. Maybe you have, maybe they haven't had it tough. Maybe they have and you don't know about it. But you don't know what they're going to face in 2 years' time. You don't know what's coming for them or for you. And I think it's really important, isn't it? Because otherwise you end up going, you can get very, not that you're angry that other people feel well, but you're angry that you don't feel well, or you're angry that you can't deal with it, or that you have this anxiety, which is not fair on yourself, let alone them.
Absolutely. I really like that. What a compassionate way to look at things. You may have, you know, you don't know what they're going to go through. I really like that. Mm. I'm going to steal that.
It's something I've really, you know, I do a lot of sondering. I love the word to sonder. I love it. Sondering is one of my favourite phrases. And it's kind of just looking around.
It's in his calendar. I saw it before.
Yeah, sondering. I love it because it's kind of, you're looking around just thinking, right, okay, like there's a lot of other people going through a lot of stuff at the moment. And it just helps you ground and put things into perspective. It's kind of like other people like it where, you know, you kind of have the moment like we're standing at this pagoda in rainy central London. You zoom out and you're like, okay, think of the UK on the map, then you think of Europe, and then you zoom up further, you think of the planet, then you think of the solar system, galaxy, you know, all this stuff, and you realize how small your issue actually is. Even when it actually is quite a big problem, it's still tiny compared to everything else. And I think it's not to diminish people's problems, but I think it's to allow some perspective on those problems, to realize actually it's going to be okay, because you won't be the first, last, or infinite, or the first thousand, or the last thousand people to go through this, right? Yeah. They agree, the ducks agree, the geese agree.
They vehemently disagree.
Do you think so? Is that a disagreement?
Yeah. And they are not sondering at all.
No, they're not sondering.
It will feel, but I think a lot of people with large internal critics, the bullies, inner bullies sometimes, they feel like they are the spotlights on them. And because we're humans and we like to problem solve and fix, we can often see anxiety or mental health or things like that as the people with the inner critics see that as a failure. I have not fixed this yet. You know, picture the frustrated mechanic who's worked on this car for about like 6 months, still can't get it to work, doesn't know why. He's good at everything else, but this particular car, he's beating himself up. When actually, car's a write-off, it's gone, doesn't even have an engine, you know what I mean? And sometimes, and that's not like what humans have, sometimes it's okay to leave it alone and not see it as failure. It's all right. So you can just be like, I need to fix how I feel constantly. And when we're talking about toxic wellness culture and stuff like that before, it's like, stop trying to fix yourself. You're not broken. In most cases, you're not broken. And a lot of the things that you can do are less. Less is more. I love telling people to be lazy because it's great. It activates the parasympathetic nervous system if you do it right. And that's brilliant. And that's healthier for you than being in fifth gear all the time and chasing the I shoulds and stuff like that. So, yeah, I just think it's, beware of that inner critic. It will always tell you what you're not doing. It will tell you what you've done wrong. And just it's just one voice at the table in your mind of a lot of other voices.
Particularly if you have a strong inner monologue. And we were talking, me and Emma actually were talking about this, is that, you know, about half of, there's research about half of all people have like a inner monologue. They've got that voice in their head, and you know, half of you listening probably will say yes and the other half will say no. And it just depends how you kind of, how your thoughts present themselves, but also how you kind of narrate that. But I do wonder and suspect for those that have a strong inner monologue like myself, you are probably more likely to have that intensity of critic because there's literally a voice in your head. Yeah. It's a great interesting challenge. You know, if you listen to this now, ask yourself that question. Do you talk? Do you narrate in your head? Do you have discussions in your head about things? Or do you see things through images, sounds, pictures, or, you know, is it just more like thoughts that pop into your head? Because then you can decide. So I mean, I think generally you either know that you do, or if you don't think you do, you probably don't have an inner monologue.
Yeah, but I don't know if I do. Sometimes. I don't know. Mm. It's weird. Yeah. Some people are like, no, definitely. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know.
And it's an interesting one because I don't know whether it's a strength or a weakness, because in some ways thoughts pop into your head. And if you have a monologue, you can kind of be like, okay, I'm literally letting that go. Mm. But also the negative side of it is that perhaps you can really get into a negative conversation, which I can easily do. So I think that I think it's controlling that voice in your head is very important. If you have that internal monologue and it is a strong one, then it's kind of making sure you got it to grips with that. Otherwise, you're just perpetuating thought cycles.
Knowing when to ignore it as well, whether it's anxiety, critic, even when you're being like self-congratulatory sometimes and getting a bit kind of, you know, like, all right, you're getting a bit, your head's just going to explode, you're carried away. Knowing when to kind of pick the right voices and stuff. In my book, I talk about how we all have a table of thoughts. And I explain as a therapist behind the in all the voices in my head talking whilst I'm trying to do therapy. And that applies to just every day as well. These voices go around everywhere. Just the rationalization of trying to make a decision. Critics like, you can't do that. And compassionate voices like, yeah, you can. And anxiety's like, but what if this happens? You know, analytical's like, you're overthinking and stuff like that. And trying to navigate those voices. But sometimes in life, one voice will stand up at the table and try to dictate. And it's like, no. This is a team effort here. When you sit down, you're taking up too much attention.
Try and get control of those contributors. So I think as we come to the end of part two then, I just want to touch upon, not in the sense that we're touching upon it in terms of it's not hugely important, because it is, but I'd like to cover something around you know, the difference between anxiety and a panic attack. Now, you know, something, you know, I understand this, but I want you, from your experience and your expertise, just to really share what that difference is. You brilliantly explained anxiety. I really like that kind of pick and mix explanation you did. So yeah, what is a panic attack and why does it happen?
A panic attack is the sudden urge that something awful, this urge, a sudden feeling, overwhelming feeling that something awful is about to happen, usually accompanied by the feeling of needing to escape where you are, no matter where you are, or run or do something. It often starts with a whoosh, like a whoosh, in an incongruous situation. So you could be in Regent's Park. I've had many panic attacks in a park in serene surroundings, which makes it feel worse because you're like, I'm supposed to be relaxed. This feeling feels not conducive to my situation. Using the pick and mix before, but applying it to panic attacks, you're going to have lots of physical symptoms. Now, if you're watching stuff on like Netflix and Hollywood and stuff, panic attacks are misrepresented. You're not rolling around on the floor, you know, gasping for breath, crawling to the door. Maybe some of you do. In my practice, I've worked there for 7 years. I've not seen one panic attack like that. It's often a freeze, an internal freeze, and an analysis for how to get out. And then it's followed by a misinterpretation of the huge adrenaline rush that you're having. Mm. So this is why people end up, and you must have seen them in A&E.
Yeah.
I'm here. Heart's pounding, must be a heart attack. My thoughts are racing, I must be going crazy. I may collapse, I'm going to faint. I'm going to lose control and do something outrageous. And it's really intense and frightening. They don't last for long. They feel like they last for long, but they don't last for long. It's one huge adrenaline rush. So take your week's worth of adrenaline that you'd have throughout the week, make yourself really stressed or see a traumatic trigger for some people, but mostly it's stress. Make yourself really stressed and then add that tiny bit more stress, that extra drop to your stress jug, and your threat response, the amygdala in your brain will go, I don't get why you're stressed. Have a week's worth of adrenaline in 10 minutes. Woof! You know, highly recommend them. They're great fun. Really, most terrifying experience of my life. Now I don't fear them because I know what they are. Ah, it's an adrenaline surge. It's adrenaline rush. Okay, it's happening when I'm on the train to London. So what?
I like the I use the analogy, and I was just talking to children about this the other day, that it's almost as if there's a saber-toothed tiger in the room. Like, imagine the amount of adrenaline you kick out if there's a saber-toothed tiger there. Fair enough, you're going to run away from the saber-tooth, but you're doing that in a room, in the classroom, or outside in the sunshine when there ain't the saber-toothed tiger, but your body is acting as if it is. And I like that because it kind of brings, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, there would be a lot of adrenaline if there's a saber-toothed tiger come back from extinction and it's going to eat us now. Fair enough, let's kick it out, let's run, get the heart rate going. But it's a very, very frightening feeling when you're looking around thinking this is awful. And I don't have a reason why it's happening. You know, that's a frightening thing, isn't it?
It steps in. It's the body trying to look after you because it doesn't understand subjective stresses. It's the fight or flight response, or the fight, flight, freeze and fawn response, as we refer to it. And it's the oldest part of our brains. That part of our brain is older than our thinking cognitive brain. And it's there. And
it's primitive. It's a very primitive part of the brain.
It works on a just-in-case mentality. And it will make you behave just-in-case. And it will try its best to make you behave just-in-case because that's its job. You know. But it triggers in response to threats for our ancestors. Yeah, great. Saber-toothed tiger, lion, bear, great. When you're in a classroom, it triggers sometimes as a result of stress because it doesn't understand subjective modern threats like self-esteem, emails, what people think of me, how many followers I've got on TikTok, you know, if I'm getting this job coming up, how's my relationship going, you know, am I a good person? These things, they just build up and build up and build up and build up. The oldest part of our brain, that bit called the amygdala, doesn't understand. It just sees that you're super stressed
and hits the red button.
Yep.
Bam.
And there's a myth around panic attacks. Oh, they hit you from nowhere. Not really. Every person I know who's had a panic attack said, tell me what you've done in the last 2 weeks. And they're like, oh yeah, I've had a really stressful time. I've moved house. I've done this. Even positive stress can trigger panic attacks too. People forget that. They think, oh, but I live a happy life. Yeah, but if you've just got married and moved house and had a kid and everything's going really well for you, don't forget that positive stress can
still
do that
too.
Still,
even though it's positive, doesn't mean it's not adding to that jug or adding to that pressure or adding to that expectation, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely.
So as we come to the end of part two then, I just wonder if you could give a little bit of advice to people that have experienced panic attacks, maybe had one before, you know, they kind of relate to what you're saying, but want to work on preventing them or dealing with them if they happen. Maybe that's a good way of doing it. A little bit around prevention, a little bit about dealing with them. And then in the third part, we're going to really delve into anxiety and how we can help reduce that feeling of anxiety that a lot of people have.
Yeah, of course. My first piece of advice is don't fear panic attacks. Panic attacks, if you fear panic attacks, you teach the brain, the inner meerkat, that they are a threat in themselves. So there's a lot of stuff out there about 10 tips to stop a panic attack. No. It's an adrenaline rush. It's going to be uncomfortable, but try not to avoid and run away and work on the skill of willfully tolerating it. We do the prevention afterwards, but if you're in the midst in the cycle of panic and fearing it, you don't want to be start to trying to stop them because it's happening because of the stresses. Your stress is so high. We work on that afterwards. But my first tip is always don't fear it. You are the coping technique is what I always say. You know, any coping techniques? It's like, well, you are the coping technique. you need to get the credit for tolerating this adrenaline rush. It's just a load of adrenaline and cortisol, and your body's in doubt. It always passes. It peaks after about 3 minutes and starts to come down again, you know? Then we work on the stress drug. What's in there? What have you not spoken about? What stress are you carrying in your suitcase? I love that, you know? For me, it was grief, you know? Some toxic masculinity, I don't want to tell anyone, blah, blah, blah. Getting rid of that in my drug because that's triggering this threat response, constantly going off. Then you do things like basic stuff, day-to-day things to look after yourself. Not to avoid anxiety, but to do it out of common sense. Mm. So like, actually, yeah, I should stop having a pie for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
You love pies, then, this episode, yeah, don't you? I really do think you need to get your fix of pies.
Yeah. You know, maybe I can't live on...
You'd have to go back up north to have one, though. I don't have any good pies around there.
I want one, though. I can't keep living on curly whirlies. Maybe I should have eat something green. And basic stuff like that. And then doing things like, you know, sometimes there's a reason for having panic attacks. Mostly not deep-rooted or there's a thing in my brain that I need to discover to stop the panic attacks. It's a very Hollywood way of looking at it. But, like, look at what's all in this jug. And even, you don't have to empty the whole thing out, but just empty the thing that's weighing you down the most. That usually has a huge impact. But, yeah, try not to be fearful and misinterpret the panic. You know, the worst thing you can do is like, oh, I don't go in there just in case I have a panic attack. No. Well, most of the homework I set for clients and we do together sometimes is, let's go and have a panic attack in Tesco. Okay, great. So we can teach the brain and rewire it so we don't fear it anymore. Wow. And that's how I stopped having panic attacks.
Wow. It actually reminds me of something my therapist said to me about anxiety and discomfort. To avoid the avoidance, the key is to avoid the avoidance.
Like
we're naturally trying to avoid these things, then it puts us in a worse state of anxiety around it, and then the stakes start getting higher, and oh my god. And then when you actually sit in it and go, actually, it's not so bad, almost like, you know, you mentioned grief and things, it's like we avoid the thoughts and memories of people because that triggers a feeling of grief. But when we sit and you look at that picture of them, yeah, it makes you feel sad and upset, but it's not killed you. Mm. And then each time you look at the picture, you become desensitized, and actually then you can start remembering the nice memories you had with them and so on. That avoid the avoidance is, if I was going to share one tip I've actually learned from my own therapy, that would probably be it.
Yeah.
Stop avoiding stuff. It's not going to kill you most of the time. Unless it's a saber tooth, then it will. Or a million pies. If they land on you, that would be very bad.
I love it. It's a very CBT approach to the thing. I'm an integrative therapist, so I draw upon many modalities that I talk quite a lot about in the book. But like, there's different types of therapists. And I'm a snob, so I like to combine modalities and call myself integrative. And it's a very CBT approach where, you know, we try not to avoid the fear because we end up reinforcing it. Unfortunately, I heard like a few therapy stories recently where it was like, therapist was like, if it makes you uncomfortable, don't do it. I'm like, no, don't say that. They actually want to go to this place and see this person.
Gig or go to watch the concert.
They want to go to the gig, but just their anxiety is convincing them that it's dangerous. No, we go anyway, you know, and that's... we tolerate it first and then we'll start to enjoy it. I remember doing exposure therapy from CBT, walking around a music festival, and I was not having a nice time. But I was like, no, I'm doing my brain rewiring here. By day two, I was enjoying it. I was loving it.
It's like the social anxiety, right, with not drinking alcohol for me. Like going, first of all, when I first went to the pub and I was like, oh gosh, I'm not drinking. For a lot of people listening, I'm sure you'll relate to this as well, is that a lot of us use alcohol, whether you realise it or not, you use it to kind of relax yourself in the situation, reduce anxiety and lubricate. It's called the social lubricant, right, for a reason. But when you don't drink and you go in, you don't have that crux. And all of a sudden that your feeling is, oh my gosh, this is actually quite anxiety. I'm not drinking. What are they going to think about this? Like, I don't feel relaxed. Everyone else is going to have a drink. They're going to be relaxed. Actually, when you sit in it, by maybe maximum 20 minutes, you're like, cool, I'm fine. I'm actually fine. And then after another 20 minutes, half an hour, you start enjoying yourself and you realize I never needed it in that moment. Nothing happened. And also, most of the anxiety is around what are people thinking about me. You realize they're not thinking about you in that sense, that, that they're not worried about the things you're
worried
about.
They're often thinking what you're thinking as well. I wonder what they're thinking of me.
The same thing. Yeah. Or thinking, what drink am I going to have, or whatever, or you know, what am I going to order off? I'm going to have a pie off the menu, or whatever. We really got to stop with the pies. But you know,
you've got a problem, Alex.
Yeah, you've created the problem here. But it is. I think that point of often, if you sit with things, discomfort it passes. Sitting with discomfort often dissipates discomfort, doesn't it?
Yeah, and perfect exposure. That is the exposure sometimes for social anxiety. Sometimes I mix it up with shame. Some people are afraid of shame. I'm like, go and say something shameful and sit with the discomfort and see, watch when the world does not collapse around you.
Yeah.
And actually usually get a laugh out of someone. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, my brain, my inner critic, my anxiety told me that this would happen. I'd be rejected and shunned. Actually, I am now the hero of the social group. I said something so irreverent. Yeah.
Fantastic advice. Thank you. We'll come to the end of part two there. In part three, we're going to talk about managing anxiety. We started a little bit there. We've been cheating into it a little bit there at the end of part two. But it's just so helpful to have a clear explanation of, like, what is anxiety? What happens when you're having a panic attack? And even just that knowledge, I hope, will help people listening. And they'll go, actually, it kind of makes sense now. And you know what? This is what we said earlier on in the podcast. We should be teaching this stuff at school. Imagine how much, you know, how many years of suffering we can prevent from people's lives if they had this knowledge to start with. Hey?
Oh, I'd love that.
It'd be amazing, wouldn't it? Thank you, everyone. We'll see you all in part three. Well, hopefully very soon.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.